The Guardian.
The Guardian Football Weekly Extra Podcast with James Richardson.
Meaningless encounters between different nationalities. They call them friendlies. We call it a podcast. And in today's Football Weekly, the two mix with jaw-dropping consequences. On our agenda, those midweek games, Holland, Greece, Northern Ireland and USA. We salute the big Wednesday winners. Meanwhile, England have the sloppiest night in Paris since, you know, that Rick Solomon video. Elsewhere, Sid Lowe's hanging on the telephone with the news of another big weekend in Spain and the match that's got Norwegians sailing the North Sea like their Viking ancestors, MK Dons against Grimsby in the Johnston Paint Trophy. All that plus your posts, etc. on Football Weekly Extra.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
Hello all. And in the pod today, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, James.
Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
And John Ashton.
Hello, James.
Hi to you all. What's first on the agenda then, Barry, this week?
I don't know. We barely have an agenda today.
Oh, I don't know how you can say that.
We were so stocked for things to talk about today that you, I believe...
There were too many things. We didn't know how to choose, I think.
You suggested we get someone, we find someone who knows stuff about the Dutch league. So,
faced with the...
We're really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Talking about France, England, I wanted to talk about the Dutch league.
Well,
yes.
we should point out that the last conversation we had before coming in was we were trying to establish if England were a band, which band would they be? And I think the consensus was status quo.
Well, yes. France, England, though, hey, Paul Doyle. A game that left me open mouthed with spit slowly dribbling out.
Yeah, it was pretty boring, all right. I mean, Fabio Capello said that he saw lots of signs of improvement.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it? He was stood there, kind of arms crossed, disinterested, saying in Italian, hey, it's all very well, all very well, thinking of the money. Well, the interpreter back, he's a funny looking man. Sorry, you were saying.
Yes, the only improvement that I could see was perhaps they did retain possession around midfield slightly better than normal. You know, there were periods of play where they kept the ball. You know, Hargreaves and Joe Cole and Barry were tidy.
Right.
That never looked menacing in any way.
But then when the game kicked off, things, I thought, deteriorated.
I'm looking for positives, as Irish people always do in England.
It wasn't that bad. I mean, France, World Cup finalists, it wasn't. And it's a friendly...
No, France didn't play well either. And France are very much a team in transition. They're not I wouldn't make them favourites to win the European Championship by any stretch of the imagination.
What did the French press make of this? A victory.
They said it was very boring. Oh. They said France were impotent, and England were extremely cautious to the point of outright boringness.
Right.
And they were impotent. Trezeguet, brought back from international oblivion for the first time in five matches because of injuries to other players, this was his big chance to regain affection with Dominic, and he was completely invisible throughout the match. And there's a suggestion in the French press that the team just ignore him. They don't like passing to him because he makes no effort to free himself up and find space, so they make no effort to find him either. So, and you could see Uri Begley was passing only to Anelka all night, and that was dangerous, and England couldn't cope with that. I thought Ribery and Anelka were the two class players on the pitch, and England didn't have anyone in that class. Toulalon was the best player in the middle, although he wasn't particularly sparkling with his passing, but he dominated the midfield for most of the match. One big thing that England lacked, I thought, was pace. There's a startling lack of pace. I don't know why Capello didn't choose last night to blood some
Ashley
of the younger
Young
players. Ashley Young, Bentley from the start.
They weren't on 99 caps, of course, which is a major...
Is that the priority?
Well, it was a friendly, so I guess you take whatever meaning you want.
France took it very seriously, though, which is why Mathieu Flamini was on the bench hoping to get his first cap, and Dominic wouldn't take him off. He left Makélélé on, 87-year-old Makélélé, to play entire 90 minutes when he could have showed a bit of sentiment and given Flamini a prestigious first cap against the country where he makes his living, but no.
Oh, indeed. The English press, I notice, concentrating on poor David James with lots of déjà vu, because, of course, he conceded a penalty in similar circumstances, as we all recall. But I have to say, he came out for the ball and Anelka ran into him and then flipped very
spectacularly. Yeah, but he stopped several yards short of the ball and just waited for it to roll to him.
Is that...
underestimating the pace of Anelka.
Right.
I mean, Terry lost him again, as he did. Terry had a bad game. I think that's one of the reasons that Ferdinand was made captain, because he is, along with, I would say, Rooney and Joe Cole, in my opinion, although Cole was bad last night, the only player who's guaranteed to start. You're not going to make John Terry captain because it's not certain that he's one of the best centre-backs in England.
I can't see who else. Who do you think is going to take his place? Woodgate?
Woodgate, possibly. Maybe Wheater. I'm surprised he didn't... I'm not saying Wheater is better than Terry, but it would have made sense to have a look at him last night, I would have thought, against quality opposition.
It's a fair point. Anybody else got anything to add on this? John, you're English.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I thought the way that England played was very conservative, which was slightly wrong. I thought there was two things to worry about. England were slightly conservative in the way they set the team up, and if you're going to play one up front, you do need pace on the flanks, and Cole and Beckham didn't provide that. And the other worry I thought is that the lack of confidence that the team showed. They looked scared, I thought, quite a lot of the time, and I think there's a sense that the pressure is getting to them. I think they need to get Euro 2008 out of the way and out of their minds, and they can start the World Cup qualifying campaign afresh.
There's nothing like the pressure that not playing in a major tournament brings.
Mm-hmm. And an exception to that, though, was Downing when he came on. He didn't deliver the pace that was lacking, but he did deliver the enterprise and the courage to try things, and he was pretty handy. Ashley Cole went on the overlap for him, and Ashley Cole's crossing was outrageously bad. But if Downing, who's been booed at a young age at England for being associated with Steve McClaren, if he can show courage, I don't see why the other players can't.
Indeed. Are the home nations, perhaps? Scotland, a 1-1 draw with Croatia in George Burnley's first game. Very impressive. There you go. What was it? Cranshaw and Miller scored there.
Yeah, Kenny Miller got a very good goal.
Right.
A touch of the Ronaldo's about it.
In which way?
It was very well taken, individual goal.
Oh, okay.
And good start for George Burley. You know, he got the performance he was after and he got a result. So
I saw an interesting stat about Cranshaw the other day.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the second highest number of shots on target in the Premier League after Cristiano Ronaldo this season.
But
he scored very few goals. So he must be hitting them all straight at the keeper.
Northern Ireland, a 4-1 win against Georgia. Michel Platini presenting David Healy with a special award for scoring a record 13 goals during the qualifiers, and he got another 2-1 for each side last night. It also featured, Barry, you were pointing out, Linford forward Peter Thompson scoring his first Northern Ireland goal. He's the first Irish League player since 1984 to score for Northern Ireland.
Although I do see in some quarters that his goal has been chalked up as an own goal.
Oh, that's a bit mean. That's not nice.
It's a bit harsh because it did definitely touch his hand last. But Kyle Lafferty scored two goals and he looked very sharp. Two excellent finishes.
Burnley going to struggle to hold on to him, aren't they, I think.
Yeah.
Did you have any other Irish news, Barry? Something about legs of lamb being thrown?
Oh, yeah. I meant to mention this on Monday and I just bypassed me and all the excitement. But there was a game between Ballymena and Distillery in the Irish League, Northern Ireland League, on Saturday, which ended in all sorts of trouble. During the game, a chair, a leg of lamb in a red bag and a bottle were thrown on the pitch. I noticed yesterday, an animal welfare charity has condemned this incident in which a lamb's leg was thrown onto the pitch because it speech marks, demonstrated general disregard for animal welfare.
Oh, indeed. Were they trying to book a picnic spot?
It's all
I don't know. All they needed was a table and some cutlery and they would have had...
A mint sauce as well.
Yes, of course.
Do you bring tables on your picnics?
Oh, yeah. I can't remember the last time I've been on a picnic. The only thing I bring to a picnic is 6 cans of lager.
Right. Okay, moving on then. Serie A, I'm not sure how I pronounce that, but can you please mention Luxembourg Wales friendly on Thursday, or just recognise that Wales exists within the British Isles for once? Yes to both of those, and Luxembourg beat Wales. Oh, sorry, Wales beat Luxembourg 2-0. 2 goals from Freddie Eastwood of Wolves. All rather dull. No, I can't say that.
Oh, it is, though, isn't it? It's really hard to get excited about friendlies.
I mean,
the most exciting thing I noticed last night was about in the last 20 minutes of the England game that one of the guys on The Apprentice, which I'd switched over to watch out of sheer boredom, is an absolute ringer. He looks like the love child of Crystal Palace chairman Simon Jordan and Roger Federer.
Right.
Rafe is his name. And anyone who saw The Apprentice, which I'm sure lots of people did because they were being bored by the football, might have noticed that.
Right, while you were getting bored by that, I was looking at some of the other games elsewhere around this wide world of football, and there were some terrific matches going on. USA, credit to them, for our American listeners out there, congratulations. 3-0, a victory in Poland over the Poles, as you might expect. Bocanegra, Onyewu and Lewis.
That's, I think, first time ever they've won 2 matches in a row in Europe.
Good Lord. Yeah. Who was the other
and
one?
And they're up against
they
England
might win
next.
A third now.
they're England's next opponents.
Yeah.
Wow. Look out. They're on a roll. They're like butter. They're on a roll, as the Americans indeed say.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. It's quite... Now,
what
Holland under Van Basten have been not conceding. In fact, they were the lowest conceding team in qualifying. And they were also the lowest scoring team of any of the qualifiers. Mm. Last night, they played one of the worst teams in Europe. And they concede 3 and then come back and score 4.
Conceded 3, it's worth mentioning, because they left out Edwin van der Sar to please Manchester United and brought in Feyenoord goalkeeper Henk Timmer, who had had a shocker and was at fault for all three goals. And an interesting thing about Henk Timmer is that he's stepping out with Maria Timmer, Olympic gold medalist, speed skater, and, as I'm sure he has to constantly point out, in no way related to him.
Not related, then. Good. Greece, two goals from Kanagounis, who is related to the figure you may recall playing and starring at Euro 2004. Hasn't scored in years, but he scored two belter free kicks last night against Portugal. Switzerland.
Portugal, in fairness, were without Cristiano Ronaldo, Nani, and Deco.
Right.
Still a good win.
Still a good win for the Greeks, who are warming up nicely. Germany, a 4-0 win, speaking of warming up nicely against Switzerland. And Mario Gomez looking particularly impressive there. And Romania, a 3-0 win over Russia. I mean, I could go on, but I think that's enough midweek friendlies, don't you?
So basically all the interesting midweek
Sweden.
Friendlies were the ones that
Sweden, Brazil at the Emirates in London. And Pato, your friend Pato, scored a brilliant goal. Came on, I think, for Batista. And did you see the goal at all?
No.
Oh, it was fantastic. Goalie tries to clear, and Pato's putting some pressure on him, and he actually accidentally hoofs it into Pato's back. Pato immediately, instinctively spins and lobs the ball from about 25 yards out over the keeper into the far corner. Well, that's enough friendlies. Coming up, though, we maintain our international outlook as we talk to Sid Lowe. Right, next up on our pod agenda, it is the man himself, Sid Lowe, in Spain. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
How are you? Have you got a big weekend coming up or something?
Well,
in football
me personally, or the football Spanish league.
But yeah.
I'm going to Villarreal on Saturday night to see Villarreal against Atletico Madrid, which should be really, really exciting. And then on Sunday night, I'll be at the Bernabeu for Real Madrid against Sevilla. Wow. The other big game of the weekend, and I do quite enjoy this in Spain, the game of the weekend is Barcelona against Betis in Seville, or maybe in Madrid, or maybe in Cadiz, or maybe in Huelva, or possibly somewhere else down in the south. No one really knows where it's going to be played just yet.
Why? They've got a stadium ban for that.
They've got a stadium ban. Now, what happens when you have a stadium ban? Is that the club is asked to present an alternative stadium. Now, the assumption was that Betis would probably present Cadiz's Carranza Stadium and say, we'll play there. But Betis had this cunning idea of just keeping their mouth shut, hiding under the table with their fingers in their ears and hoping it would all go away and hoping that they would leave it so late that the Federation would go, oh, bollocks, there's only a day till the game. Tell you what, play at home this week and we'll deal with it next week. Unfortunately, their bluff was called and the Federation last night said, right, you will play the game either in La Cartuja, which is the kind of the Olympic-style stadium in Seville, or if not, there's even a suggestion they may be forced to come all the way up to Madrid to play in the Calderon.
But hang on, they can't, if they're having a stadium ban, they can't play at the stadium down the road. That negates the whole purpose.
No, that's exactly what they can do. And this is one of the reasons why their reaction is kind of so bizarre, but better. So they've been really, really, really angry about this. And the last time they were given a free match stadium ban, which was last year when Juan de Ramos was hit on the head with a bottle, they played three games in the Cartuja Stadium, as I say, in Seville, which is all of 3 kilometres from their stadium, holds an extra 10,000 people, and therefore the revenue was higher and the atmosphere was better. That said, they did lose all three games they played there.
Oh, right, OK. Now, so it's a big game, though, isn't it? Because Barcelona are now 4 points behind Real Madrid, who are in something of a crisis.
Yeah, Real Madrid are in something of a crisis, and you're right, it's a big game, not just for Barca and Madrid, but also for Villarreal. We're in this bizarre situation now that I think the neutrals probably want Madrid and Barcelona to both lose this weekend, Villarreal to win, which would put them just 3 points behind, and three teams within 4 points of each other. It is a big game for Madrid, and they are in probably a crisis. Certainly, if this had happened at the start of the season, we'd all be jumping up and down and saying it was crisis, and probably Bernd Schuster would not have lasted. The fact that it's happened at the back of the season, where they'd already built up a big lead, is kind of what's protected them. They've been beaten 9 times in 2008. That's more than half of their games. I think they've lost 5 of the last 8 in La Liga. And although they played well against Valencia last weekend, there's clearly very serious problems. And some of the things that were kind of simmering earlier in the year are starting to come to the surface. And there could well be, if Madrid continue this bad run, pretty major fallout.
Well, you mentioned before that obviously the absence of Van Nistelrooy is having an impact. But what are the other issues? Is it Robinho not living up to expectations or what?
There's two or three things. I mean, in purely footballing terms, one of the biggest absentees, as well as the Van Nistelrooy one, which of course is the big absentee. And you know, I'm reluctant to say that he won the league single-handedly last year for Real Madrid, but there's absolutely no doubt that without him, they would not have won the league. The other big absentee has been Sergio Ramos, not just because of what he does on the right, but because he balances a team that is inherently imbalanced, that has no one on the right-hand side of midfield. But he's such a good athlete that he enables him to get away with that. Robinho, since he's come back from his injury and they rushed him back to play against Roma, just hasn't been right. Now, again, I'm reluctant to say that Robinho's not living up to expectations, because for the 3 months before that, he was really, really impressive. but he hasn't been right for the last four or five games. And there's just a kind of a general sense of the wheels coming off. Bernd Schuster gets more and more mad by the day. Some of the players have got a fairly difficult relationship with his number two, a guy called Manolo Ruiz. And there's just a kind of an all-round sense of, hang on a minute, Christ, this could really go wrong.
Meantime, Spain beat Italy 1-0 in their midweek friendly. Were the Spanish very excited about that?
The Spanish are absolutely delighted about this for one really important reason. And I actually think they might have a point here. The Spanish for years have been obsessed with the fact that they play very, very nice football, but they tend to lose. They're not a team that can grind out results. They're not a team that can get lucky. In other words, they're not a team that Italy are. And they've always believed that Italy have this ability to compete, this ability to be aggressive, this ability to get results when they're not actually that good, whereas Spain have been the reverse. Last night, they won 1-0 Spain. They didn't play particularly well. Italy had a perfectly good goal, as far as I could see, ruled out. And the fact they won 1-0 not playing well, everyone's suddenly going, hang on a minute, playing rubbish and winning, it's the mark of champions. And they've decided now that this is really, really good news, particularly Luis Aragonés, who for all his failings, has consistently gone on about the fact that Spain needs to learn to compete. Well, last night they did it, and last night they got the result. They've beaten France and Italy now 1-0 in friendlies, playing badly both times. And all of a sudden, playing badly is reason to believe.
Right, well, England is set for a great future then, I think, probably.
Yeah, but England have to win as well.
Oh, curses. Milan forever. I just wanted to ask Sid, there's been a lot of talk in Italy that Luis Fabiano is going to be heading to Serie A. Apparently his agent said something along those lines. I think I've seen him linked with Roma. Is there any truth in this, Sid?
Well, there's any truth in any number of possible destinations for Luis Fabiano at the moment. For what it's worth, I think the most likely is Real Madrid. He has also talked to some clubs in England. He is in an awkward situation in that, very much like Carlos Tevez, part of his registration is owned by Kier Jurabsham. Oh. I think that's how you say his name, yep. Isn't it? And only part by Sevilla. Sevilla don't want to cash in, but his contract is up at the end of the season. Jurabsham does, but he owns 15%. It's going to be messy, but it does appear that he will probably end up staying in Spain. He said last week that he wanted to leave Seville because his family wasn't happy, because not so very long ago they were held at gunpoint in a robbery at their house.
Well, you can see how that would upset things. Sid, listen, that's fantastic. Enjoy your weekend of sport wherever it might take place.
I shall try, thank you.
And we look forward to catching up with you on the weekend.
Brilliant, speak to you on Monday.
Thank you. There you go. Well, yeah, the Italians beaten. And a perfectly good goal disallowed, but I have to say that they should have had a penalty whistled against them, which the referee failed to see. So
did Camoranesi hit the bar twice?
He did, yeah. But the Italians are very much of the opinion that it was a fair result, this. And in fact, the big headline on the Gazetta this morning was a step backwards for Donadoni. But Tony did have what looked like a fairly decent header disallowed in about the 10th minute. Anyway, now, this weekend in Italy, they're calling it, no, they're not, Scudetto Saturday, but they might do, because the two teams chasing the title are playing on Saturday, Lazio against Inter. Inter, who have, I think, won two games in their last nine or something awful like that. And are fielding Zlatan Ibrahimovic against doctor's advice. There are reports in Italy, too, that Chelsea star Didier Drogba, this is in the Corriere dello Sport, has told his teammates he's going to be joining Inter in the summer, which, if you believe rumours that Jose Mourinho is heading that way, all makes sense. However, that's just a story in the Corriere dello Sport, which is not nearly as reliable as the pink paper, in my opinion. Saturday, meanwhile, also sees Cagliari take on Roma. Cagliari were on the bottom, but they've been staging a remarkable comeback despite the fact that the league had penalised them 3 points for taking a former player to court, which you're not allowed to do without league permission, and they did, so they got penalised 3 points. And since then, they've been battling brilliantly against injustice by winning games. They've now got those 3 points back, boosting them to 18th, and it's only goal difference that's keeping them in the drop zone. But I reckon they're going to collapse, because you know how the teams seem to battle well against adversity, and then... No? And then, you know, when things get sorted out for them...
We're battling well against adversity today.
Anyway, Cagliari are playing Roma, Barry. There you go. Did you know there are six teams now within 3 points of each other at the bottom of the Italian table? The bottom three have been through eight managers this season. Paul Doerr, a quick question for you from a listener. The Len Ganley stance says... Paul Doerr, how come PSG find themselves in such a mire, and how on earth has Paul Le Guen kept the job there?
Well, he's kept the job because, as apparently in L'Equipe this morning, they say that sources in the club have admitted that it's too late to sack him now, basically, because nobody could come in and save them. They're playing the League Cup final this Saturday, it's worth pointing out, against Lens. And who knows, if they win that might trigger an upsurge in confidence, and they'll go on and pull themselves out of the relegation zone, which they they currently are in. They've been very unlucky. Le Guin has taken huge risks. He's fielded reserves throughout the season, and he even handed the captaincy to a reserve team player who he just brought straight in off the reserves and made him captain, an 18-year-old, just because he felt that the team needed an infusion of new blood because the others were past it and jaded.
But it hasn't worked.
It hasn't worked, and nothing has worked for PSG in recent years. The sponsors now apparently are threatening to pull out if they go down,
right,
and all sorts of things. And it would be a huge disaster for the club, which is the only club from the French capital, obviously, and are one of the best supported teams in France.
Good Lord, eh? Meanwhile, Lyon at the other end have romped away with it again.
Yeah, they're going to make it 7 in a row.
Oh, my word. Helpful suggestions have been abounding on the posts this week. Villa Support Group has an idea. We do a daily Football Weekly pod. You can call it Football Weekly, but you cut it down to 15 minutes to go over all the saucy football developments, cut, paste and remix James's voice from previous shows to fill in the offensive puns and Italian bits, while Barry, Ingle or whoever happens to be in the GU office can improvise the rest. Or am I describing the existing pod, says Villa Support Group.
He's not too wide in America, is Mr. Villa Support Group.
All right. Lots of American listeners blogging in and saying, as one man, please, please, please don't make any more comments on the MLS if you don't know anything about it, which I think has been fairly well demonstrated by now. We're really not clear. But thanks for your kind comments anyway, American listeners. Jeff Cito says American League's more interesting anyway than the MLS, and he wants to give Sid Lowstyle updates from Mexico City by telephone. Crocodile Wenger writes in with an exciting report on the Australia-China game, which was actually a meaningful game for the 2010...
So, World Cup qualifier, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
1-1 draw?
0-0 draw, a mind-numbing 0-0 draw played at altitude in Kunming. The Chinese have moved the game there to disrupt our brave boys, says Crocodile Wenger, and had been training there for weeks, fiendish stuff, but the Sheilerys controlled the game apart from Schwarzer conceding an 88th-minute penalty, which he then saved with his legs to win the Great Wall of China nickname in this morning's tabloids. Fantastic. And rough patch with the exciting news that I've been nominated in the Sports Presenter category in the RTE Guide TV and Radio Awards. So get voting.
There's some quality opposition there.
Wow, they're running scared. Adrian Charles, Gabby Logan, Michael Leister, and Bill O'Herlihy, and Trevor Welch.
Michael Leister is the RTE's GAA presenter, and Bill Hurling and Gaelic football. Bill O'Herlihy is the man whose job it is to rein in Eamon Dunphy's rants on during Champions League coverage.
Right.
He's a sort of a jovial chap from Kerry, isn't it?
Cork.
Oh, Cork.
Right. John, sorry. And you're being very patient over there. Your time is coming in part three when we discuss this weekend's events.
This is Guardian Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
OK, now, the weekend then, and it brings some big, big matches. First of all, the Johnston Paints Trophy. MK Dons taking on Grimsby in front of a packed house at Wembley, Barry.
They are.
Including
several. Well, we should probably tell some of our foreign listeners may not know. Indeed, some of our English listeners may not know what the Johnston's Paint Trophy is. It's a competition for the third and fourth tiers in English football, and I think a select group of invitees from the conference.
Oh, yeah.
And anyway, Grimsby are playing Paul Ince's MK Dons in the final on Sunday at Wembley. I think both teams have sold their allocations of 26,000 tickets, so it should be a full house. And it's a nice day out for fans of teams who obviously don't get to Wembley very often.
Right.
And
very often.
Well, ever.
And they're streaming in from all over Europe.
They are, indeed. I was just doing a bit of research, all too rare research for Football Weekly, and there's an entourage of Grimsby Town fans from Norway coming. And there's apparently Grimsby Town have a lot of fans in Norway, which came as news to me and may come as news to a lot of Grimsby Town fans as well. One guy, Jostein Jensen, 29, from Stavanger, and apologies if I'm pronouncing it wrong. He's apparently absolutely buzzing with the thought of getting the chance to see both Grimsby and the new Wembley. I'm embarrassed to say that I've only seen the Fishermen live when they've been touring Scandinavia, but now I just had to crash the pig, he said. And I'm not sure what the Ulster Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals would make of that.
Indeed.
Then there's another guy, Lars Olav Sather, who explains how he became a Grimsby Town fan.
Right.
When and we should probably have the Hovis music or something playing in the background here. But as a little boy, I walked along the beach at Havilah and saw what the ocean had brought ashore. One day I found a fishing box of polystyrene foam that wasn't Norwegian. It said Grimsby on it in major letters. After looking in books, I found out it was a town that was among UK's biggest regarding fish. Since Havilah also is known for fishing, Grimsby came like an English answer to my hometown. Of course, I also found out that the town had a football team. Since then, I have followed the teams on its ups and downs.
That's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
That's really nice. Will they be washed up, do you think, on the... Dons, they're powerful, because Grimsby are a ninth, as we all know, in League Two, and I think 5 points off the promotion place. But MK Dons, under Paul Ince, who's destined for big things, so everyone says, are destined themselves for League One. They're in first place.
They are indeed, yep. And they've beaten Grimsby twice this season.
Oh, have they?
2-0 at Grimsby, 1-0 at home. We also had another foiled attempt to get in touch with...
He's just not...
Paul Ince doesn't want to hear from you.
Doesn't want to know.
Because you left a message on his phone this morning.
It was fairly
pitiful, actually.
Yeah.
Could you ring me back, if only to tell me to stop ringing you and bothering you?
I don't know if listeners will recall Tony Blackburn's live calls to his... Trish? No, what was the name of the girl that he was...
I remember Alan Partridge trying to get in touch with Roger Moore in his inaugural show, which also bombed.
Right. Not sure what you mean by that. But Now, elsewhere in the Premier League, a busy fixture list, and hard to know where to start with this, but John, what catches your eye? I'm particularly excited by the Merseyside derby, Everton with a real chance to spoil Liverpool's season. If they win, they go into fourth place?
Yeah, but will it happen? It's one of those... You've got the sense of the last sort of 6 or 8 weeks that Everton's season is petering out slightly. Yeah. And Liverpool have just come good, and it's sort of a slightly, you know, although they'll get the big build up, you feel that it's inevitable that Liverpool will
get the result. They had the measure of Liverpool in the first game, although Clattenburg obviously didn't referee to the required standard.
Yeah, but that's a while ago now, and I think Liverpool have improved since then.
All right.
And aren't on the roll. That's my...
Well, Liverpool weren't too hot last Sunday against Man United. Mm. And also, if Andy Johnson is fit, he could expose Carragher's lack of pace, which even Rooney did last weekend. So I would give Everton hope.
Oh, certainly there's hope, isn't there? But you feel the momentum is all Liverpool's at the moment, I would say.
Right. Tottenham, Newcastle. Goals?
You have to think so, which might suggest there won't be any goals. Newcastle got their long overdue win last weekend. Whether they can build on it or just lose again remains to be seen. Only time will tell, I suppose. But Newcastle don't generally do very well on their trips to London, and I suspect they'll lose this one as well.
They're 6 points clear now of the bottom three, which currently features Derby at the bottom, Fulham and Bolton. Bolton are taking on Arsenal, who have fallen to 6 points off the top. And Bolton are kind of the bogey team for the Gunners, aren't they?
Arsenal haven't done well away to Bolton in recent seasons.
But Anelka was still involved in this.
Anelka was involved. Allardyce was involved. I don't think the Bolton team that's... Megson's Bolton is as good as or as effective as Allardyce's was. But Arsenal are playing really badly at the moment. They're not scoring goals, and they could possibly drop points here.
Well, given how Didier Drogba beat up Cole Touré and William Gallas, particularly in the air last week, and you imagine Kevin Davis will be in there.
Oh, he'd be rubbing his hands together,
flying.
I'd say, yeah.
Right, interesting. So you think they could fall further off the pace?
Speaking of Stavanger, as we were earlier on for some reason, I think your man Greta Steinsen, the Bolton right-back, was signed from there. And I think he's the slowest professional footballer in activity.
Really?
And Arsenal will surely look to exploit that.
Good Lord. OK, well, a tricky match for the Gunners then. Elsewhere in the title race, let me see. Well, obviously the big thing is Man United, who are now 5 points clear, at home to Aston Villa, who are slumping in the worst way right now and appear to have packed up for the season already.
And who always fold at Old Trafford.
All right, well, there you go. And Chelsea, meanwhile, are at home to Middlesbrough.
And Middlesbrough, I think Paul made the point somewhere recently, I don't know if it was in an article or a pod or whatever, that Middlesbrough take more points off
the big teams,
the big four teams, than any other team.
But not at Stamford Bridge.
I can't see Chelsea losing, but they could possibly, Middlesbrough could get a draw.
Well, I rather doubt it, but there you go. Derby, Fulham, and Fulham, this is kind of a last chance for them, isn't it? But if they can beat Derby and Bolton and Birmingham both lose, the Cottage should be back to just 1 point from safety.
It's also a big one for Derby, isn't it, really? Because it's surely their last chance to get another win in the Premiership and try and avoid breaking the record for the lowest point tally ever in the Premiership. So, you know, if you're a Derby fan.
They need 5 points in seven games.
Yeah, yeah, and they probably if they don't beat Fulham on Saturday, they won't get it.
Right.
So I'm sure Derby fans are really in a weird way looking forward to Saturday because it's a big chance to get a result. And they had Sunderland there. Was it at Sunderland or was it at Pride Park? And they lost Sunderland, and that was one of their big chances as well.
Right.
So I've got a slight soft spot for Derby because that's where I spent much of my youth.
Really, Tom?
Yes, indeed. And it'd be quite nice to see them just get one more win before the end of the season. And Saturday's the big chance.
John, listen, your other soft spot, of course, Sheffield United. And how are things there?
We're on a roll at the moment, James. We've won four on the bounce.
Right. Remember, it's like butter, yeah?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I was going to slip that one in then, but slip on the butter, I don't know.
No, you have to be American to say that.
Do you want to slip that one in with butter?
Yes, last tango in Sheffield.
But yeah, we've moved into mid-table safety, which is great, and it's a nice sort of positive atmosphere around the club. We won't make the playoffs. There's too many teams between us and the playoffs.
Right.
But it's an incredibly close race up at the top of the Championship still.
Well, there you go. And that is today's Football Weekly Extra. And Barry, I mean, back at the start, wondering what we were going to talk about today.
Yeah.
There you go, eh? Fantastic. A rip-roaring ride through the wide world of football. And many, many thanks for being on board, Barry Glendenning.
You're very welcome.
John Ashton.
Not at all.
And Paul Doyle.
Thanks, James.
Not at all, producer Gamby. And you listeners, if you're still there. We'll be back on Monday. And I hope you'll be joining us then. For now, though, from all of us here, bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.